You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 161, translating Genesis 1 through 11. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's a scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Very good. Another busy week, but, you know, that's good. It's good to be productive.
I hear you. Well, this week we got two special guests.
Well, you know, one I know from Wisconsin, my days in graduate school in the Hebrew department, and the other is new to me, but they've partnered together on a new translation of Genesis 1 to 11. But it's more than a translation, as we're going to find out. It's a significant work in terms of the notes that are put into the translation effort. I will say more about it, obviously, as we get into discussing it with them, but this is something that I think people would really benefit greatly from if they were to get this, read through the translation, and just take advantage of, you know, something that really answers the question, what do translators think about, and more importantly, what are they supposed to think about? It's a great resource.
Awesome. Let's get to it.
Well, we're thrilled to have John Hobbins with us and Samuel Bray. Now, I know John from the University of Wisconsin Hebrew Department Graduate School Experience. We'll just call it an experience for the sake of our discussion here. I've not met Sam until, you know, we connected here today, but they have what I think is a very interesting work out. It's a new translation of Genesis 1 through 11. That is really hot off the presses here. And we'll talk about how you can get that toward the end. But I'd like to begin by asking both of you guys, you know, in any particular order you want, to introduce yourself. And then we'd like to know a little bit as well about your translation experience and sort of, you know, what the roles were in this joint production. You know, how'd the partnership form? And then you know, how did it work? So let's just start there. If you can introduce yourselves, that'd be great.
Go ahead, Sam.
I'm Sam, and I'm a law professor at UCLA. Actually, this year I'm a Harrington Faculty Fellow at the University of Texas, Austin. So I have two university affiliations. But my background is all in the law and not in biblical studies, and except where there's overlap between the two. So I've drawn on biblical scholarship for work on figures of speech in the law. But I'm John's partner in this, but my area of expertise is in the law and in language and in the use of language in the law and here in our translation.
Good. And so, as Mike was saying, my expertise is more in languages. We got to know each other through being students in the Hebrew department in Madison, Wisconsin, at University of Wisconsin. And it was there that I picked up some languages very early on. I learned Hebrew and Greek when I was about 13 years of age. It was a good time to learn it because it sort of sunk into my bones. And it's been a part of who I am ever since. I'm a pastor, but I've also taught Hebrew in various places, in Rome and in Madison and in Oshkosh. Teaching Hebrew in about a month in Gambela, Ethiopia. So it's Hebrew is a language that means a lot to me. And I've been involved in various translation projects as a consultant before. And at a certain point, Sam approached me. He was working on a translation for the sake of his children, reading the Bible to them. And it was at that point that we connected. He had read some of what I've written online. I used to have a blog. It's still available, but I'm no longer posting regularly about issues of translation often, and poetry in particular, how that can be translated and how that can be understood, ancient Hebrew poetry. So we connected just because of what I had online available to anyone. He emailed me and things sort of took off after a little while.
So, Sam, this is kind of interesting. I mean, what translation enterprise were you working on for your kids? I mean, what was the procedure there? What were you trying to do? What was the goal?
I was trying to decide on what the best translation would be to use at home for reading aloud. And the natural choice for me for something in the Tyndall KJV tradition, which I wanted because it would have a network of allusions and connections with hymns and literature and Christian culture, would be something like the ESV or the NRSV. And so I had used both and had used a lot of other English Bible translations. And I was trying to decide which one I wanted to use for reading every day. And so it would form in the memory of my kids. And the problem was the ESV is just often, despite being a good translation, just is awkward when read aloud. It doesn't have the same attention to rhythm and grace that I would expect in really good writing. And sometimes I hit sing-song passages. Like there's one in where Cain says to God in Genesis 4, "You've driven me today away." And that's the sort of thing I wouldn't let stand in my own writing. And so I was, I guess my standards for how the writing sounded when it was read aloud were very high. And so I was frustrated with it. And the NRSV paraphrases on all the gender points. And so I wasn't really happy with either one. So I was trying to do some adaptation and some translation. And I had been a longtime reader of John's blog. And I knew we had similar attitudes toward translation and its need to be close and its need to be literary and its need to preserve the imagery and physicality of the original. And so I approached John, and the partnership has just taken off.
You know, I'll tell you what that reminds me of, especially the sing-songy thing. And I imagine some people are listening to this and thinking, well, that's kind of an elitist view. Like, who cares about what it sounds like reading aloud? And, you know, shouldn't it communicate to the average Joe? And, you know, all this, you know, basically a utility approach to it. But I think that there would be a tendency to not appreciate what you're saying because we don't hear extensive passages of scripture read anymore. What it makes me think of back in my Wisconsin days, we had a woman who worked with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And there were a couple of occasions where our pastor was on vacation or whatever. And, you know, naturally there would be the need for pulpit fill. And one week, he asked her to fill in, and I think they were sort of in cahoots with this, because what she did, and I believe what he asked for, because he sort of knew that she was good at this, was she got up and she did nothing for 30 minutes but read the text. And she was just an excellent reader, and it was so memorable. I was asked to do pulpit fill a month ago. And I was waffling between, do I want to do, you know, some sort of message that I really thought the church needed to hear, or am I going to just get up and read? And I, you know, not pretending I could do it as well as this person I'm thinking did, but it's so absent that if you're not used to hearing it, and especially read from something that is just well written, you can't really understand what you're missing. I don't know if any of that resonates with you, but that's the first thing that popped into my head.
Absolutely.
You know, we just don't hear it. We don't hear scripture that often, which is kind of startling to say. I mean, maybe John, you know, you do a little bit more reading because I know you work hard at producing your own fresh translations for sermons. So it probably goes hand in glove with that. But I think the average person just has not had the experience of hearing scripture read at length.
Yeah, it really is an amazing experience to translate the Bible afresh and to try to capture some of the figures of speech, some of the metaphors in a way that perhaps hasn't been done very often, although the older English translation tradition, Tyndall and King James, often did a better job than is now the case with more modern translation theories. There are other priorities, but we decided to return to some of the strengths of the earlier translations, one of which is the ability to be heard and to be understood when spoken. Another has to do with being attentive to form and structure, not just content, because we believe all three of those things are interrelated. And also an attentiveness to the history of interpretation. So we're interested in our translation work to see how the passage has been understood over time. I'll tell one funny story. I once went to Missouri to visit relatives, and I was asked to guest preach at my aunt's church. And they said, you can choose a passage and you can do whatever you want. And so I chose Ezekiel 16, which is a very long passage. And Mike knows what I'm talking about. And I retranslated the whole thing. You know, most of it, it's full of sexual innuendo, as a matter of fact. And the preacher for whom I was preaching that day, I was his guest, looked at the passage ahead of time, and he figured, oh no, this is horrible. What am I going to do? So he read it in the King James. He read it very poorly, and so no one understood it. And then little did he know that I had the whole thing translated again. And you could not hear a pin drop after I gave it in my translation, because no one had ever heard it as Ezekiel would have given it. And it wouldn't have mattered what I said afterwards, because I had their attention, their complete attention.
Right.
And so
did you start looking for the exits at that point?
At that point, a lot of red faces. But, you know, there's a power to Scripture, and also to Genesis 1 through 11. Many of these passages are full of suspense and full of a plot that's very interesting. And each twist and turn is worth paying attention to, also in translation.
Well, I don't want you to get blindsided, but toward the end here, you know, I'll ask either one of you to pick, you know, a passage out and just read it, so we get a little bit of a feel, you know, for the translation. But you know, that's for later. You can be thinking about it as we talk here. So you've already gotten into this next question I have written down, because I read the preface to the translation. I read a good portion of the translation as well, you know, prior to this point, just to get a feel for it, but the question I have here in front of me on my list next is, what were you trying to fix? In other words, what are you trying to do better? And you've already alluded to some of these things. So if you could, by way of an answer to this, if you could sort of pick out a few things in the preface where you're explaining to the reader just this, what do you see as the problem, and what are you trying to fix, and how are you proposing to fix it? If you can give us an idea of some of the issues, because we've talked about like how we got our Old Testament, how we got our New Testament on the podcast before. And at the end, I append something about, hey, you know, read the preface of your Bible. You know, it's going to talk about whether they leaned formal equivalent, you know, word for word, you know, correspondence, or dynamic equivalent, thought for thought. I mean, so this audience is a little bit familiar with sort of the two major, you know, options that get batted around. But you're after more than that, and you've already alluded to that. So if you can take us through some of the things you were trying to fix and how you're approaching them.
So one thing I think we were trying to fix is attention to the repetition in the text. Repetition is not something that's usually considered good English style right now, but it's pervasive in the Bible. And often the way that meaning gets constructed in biblical stories is through layer after layer of repetition, and then sometimes a repetition with a crucial variation. Mm-hmm. So a couple instances of that are one in Genesis 3, where the serpent promised to Adam and Eve, if they ate of the fruit of the tree of the garden, the serpent says this, to Eve when he's talking to her, God knows that on the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like gods, knowing good and evil. And then, of course, we all know what happens next in the plot. I think it won't be I won't be spoiling the plot for anybody to say. Eve eats, Adam eats, and then what happens? And then what happens is that they know that they are naked. And so you get a repetition of the same word. They were supposed to know good and evil, but instead, what they know is that they're naked. So you get this profound irony and this sense of bitter disappointment. A lot of translations wash that out. They say that if you eat the fruit, the serpent promises you will know good and evil, but then they realized that they were naked. And so you've lost this crucial connection, this echo reverberating through the text that's supposed to show you just how disappointed they are. One more example is before the flood, it says that humans have ruined the earth, and God is going to bring ruin upon them because they've ruined the earth. You get a repetition of the same verb stem.
Yeah, it's the same lemma, yeah.
Exactly. But in a lot of English translations, it says that humans have destroyed the earth, and then, or rather corrupted the earth. They've corrupted the earth, and then God is going to destroy them. So what you miss is this sense that the divine justice is kind for kind, measure for measure, in exact proportion to what humanity has done. That's a crucial part of the text, and we want to try to carry that over.
Yeah, ruin for ruin there. I mean, this audience, and it's not usually a translation issue per se, but we do a lot of connecting Old and New Testament, how the New Testament writers cite the Old Testament a lot. And so I'm hoping that this audience is used to hearing me remember hearing me say things like, look, when the writer picked this phrase or picked this lemma, they intentionally want your mind, they assume, again, because they're writing for people in their own time period, their own audience, their immediate audience, they assume that your mind will go back to a particular passage. You know, again, this connection, this resonance between this word or phrase, that they'll be able to pick up on what he's doing in the writing. And so that's a good example of doing that in English, where, you know, when you do have repetition of Hebrew words, and of course, again, we have to assume that's intentional, you know, that there's some stylistic intent behind that, that if you keep translating that same term with different English terms, you're never going to pick up on that. And it's really important if the Old Testament is repurposing some other portion of the Old Testament. You know, and it can only be a word or a phrase, but that, you know, how one incident or one statement will get threaded through other passages later on through the Hebrew Bible. So if your vocabulary is not reflecting that, you'll never see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see that in a number of keywords in Genesis 1 through 11. A good example is on the seventh day, God blesses something, and then we translate, and he hallowed it. And the word hallow is dropped out of most translations now. Mm-hmm. However, it's familiar to most Christians because it occurs in the Lord's Prayer, hallowed be thy name. And if you only preserve it, that's basically what's happened now. If this word is only preserved in the Lord's Prayer, and it's been some other words, some other equivalents, sometimes very paraphrastic, have been introduced elsewhere in Scripture, then all the connections have been severed. Yeah. You don't really see how holiness and hallow even fit together, and a lot is lost. So we're trying to preserve some of these connections.
Yeah, for my audience, I'll give a familiar illustration again of this. A big point of irritation every time I hit it, the New Testament, I have to complain about it. And that is the translation saints. You know, it's Hagioi. Why don't you translate it holy ones? Because that will take your mind back to holy ones in the Old Testament. You know, and then you get this, you can recover sort of the sense that, well, initially humans were supposed to be part of the divine family. Eden is where heaven intersects with earth. God comes down to dwell with man. I mean, there's all these concepts that accrue or at least can accrue, ought to accrue to language like this. But, you know, we if we don't create those connections as translators between the two testaments, no one will ever sort of get a sense of, oh, holy ones. Well, that has a history. Who are the holy ones back in the Old Testament? Well, it can be, you know, members of the heavenly host. It can also be people. And why would it be both? Why would they do that? Well, again, there are theological ideas that accrue and attach, you know, to just a wording like that, but it's just lost. You'll never see it again because of the way that the text is treated. Do you have any other examples? Or I can move on to something else, and I'll just do that along with this. What about structure? I know you're big on structure, John. You know, with not only your blog but just generally your interest in poetry. What's wrong with the way most English translations convey both poetic structure and then also just other issues of structure, other kinds of structure, and how do you propose to fix that, or how are you trying to address it?
Well, one way to talk about this is to, if you read Hebrew and you're familiar with the lexical stock of Hebrew, it seems quite limited. And in some ways, it's not as extensive as one might have thought, just in the abstract. And so one way to describe this is the plainness and the simplicity of the diction of the Hebrew Bible. And we really do our best to preserve this. You might call it embracing simplicity, but on the other hand, to accomplish this is a very complex process because there are always trade-offs. That's the thing about translation. There is no such thing as one obvious translation and all the other ones are obviously wrong. It's not that simple. But to make a choice to not gussy up the language of the text before us just because it's easy for us to do in English requires a form of discipline that I think is lacking in a lot of modern translations. When you have a verbalist clause in Hebrew, for example, how many translations would just fill in with a verb that sounds natural in English? Mm-hmm. Instead, if at the structural level too, how a narrative works, we go back to what you find in the early modern English translations, like the King James. We carry over the and structure in the narrative, okay. And that's a choice that one or two modern recent English translations have also done, but it is very. It might even be counterintuitive to most people to do that. And then I think the proof is in the pudding. Try it out. See if this works for you. My experience with a translation like this is that if it's read aloud, for example, by someone who's an excellent reader, all of a sudden connections that otherwise would have been missed become crystal clear.
Can you give us an example of like a poetic structure or again, just where structuring matters? You know, maybe the Lamech passage. I mean, obviously this isn't, you know, the Psalms or anything like that in Genesis 1 through 11. But there are, you know, little portions where something is structured deliberately that, you know, this kind of thing can help or at least avoid some sort of misunderstanding. Does anything come to mind specifically?
One structuring device in Genesis, not just 1 to 11, but throughout Genesis, is the Toledot formula. These are the generations of X. And that formula marks the seams between a number of major units. And for the reader to pick that up, you have to give it a consistent translation all the way through.
I notice also that you made that like a header, like the yes. First verse when you have the Toledot. So that conveys... It's a very simple typeset stylistic thing that conveys the fact that this is a new section.
Right. And that's exactly right. So we italicize and center the Toledot formula. So in Genesis 2:4, these are the generations of the heavens and the earth as they were created. And behind that is not only a desire to follow the text closely, but also a kind of interpretive modesty. Instead of putting in our own titles for the different sections, yeah. to try to guide the reader, like think that right. this is the following subject. Instead, we're trying to get out of the way as much as possible. Let the text speak about its own categories and its own genres.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, again, my experience, like teaching on the undergrad level, or even. You know, even having a discussion in church, you know, this section of this chapter is about this topic. Well, how do you know that? Look right here. You know, that my study Bible gave it a header. And so that predisposes the person, the reader, to think certain thoughts that, you know, and I'm not saying it's sinister and evil, but it may miss the point, or it may leave their thinking in some other direction that will cause them to kind of miss, you know, what's going on here.
It also gives you permission to stop reading. And so when you see that, like Genesis 6:9 running all the way into the beginning of or partway through chapter 9 is the story of Noah and the flood, and there's just no break. It just keeps going. Then you're supposed to read it all as
you're supposed to keep going. Yeah. All right. I have a question for you about the Toledot. If you look at we're in Genesis chapter 10, and you get to, you know, verses 26, 27, or it's actually Genesis 11 here. Right in the middle there at 27 is these are the generations of Terah. And that is not centered and put off, you know, as a header in what I'm looking at. Maybe I just have a pre-publication version of this, but is that intentional? And why would you keep the generational note there in the running text instead of breaking it out?
So if you go back to the Dead Sea Scrolls, those are our oldest manuscripts of books of the Bible in Hebrew. You already have what are later called sections, Sittumot and Pituchot, open and closed sections, a variety of ways of paragraphing, even though the term paragraph is a little bit of a misnomer because you're talking about usually much longer units. Usually in Genesis 1 through 11, already in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the fragments that we have, the paragraphing follows a tradition that's pretty stable. And in this one instance, there is no paragraph break. And so we make them, the Toledot formula, into headers when they are at the juncture of a section break. And that's interesting to reflect upon why there isn't one here, because it's an exception. Mm-hmm. And I've thought we have extensive notes that I think people will really find interesting, because if you
are you going to publish them?
They're in with the translation.
Okay.
Yeah, they're
right. You're talking about those notes. Okay,
those notes I think will be very interesting to many people, because I know how many serious students of the Bible like to compare one translation to another, but mm-hmm. they have no way, because they don't necessarily know any Hebrew, to make some sort of informed comparison. And we do our best to give the reader a chance to sort of get beneath the hood and see mm-hmm. how this operates. And that applies also to the sections. What we discovered, which is interesting, is that the passage that begins with Genesis chapter 11, verse 10, these are the generations of Shem, that in many Masoretic manuscripts is a major division, which doesn't come to a conclusion until chapter 12, verse 9. So that was just an illumination for me to read this and work very closely with the manuscripts, not just with a particular printed edition, and discover that for many, there's a long tradition going back all the way to before Christ to read Genesis 11 verse 10 through 12 verse 9 as a unit. And if you do so, you discover some things that otherwise you would just miss. That's mm-hmm. what paragraphing does. That's what division does. We block things in a certain way, and then we see things we would not otherwise see.
One place that happens is Genesis 10, where there's the sons of Noah, and it's the table of nations about the different nations that come from Shem and Ham and Japheth. And if you look at an English Bible, unless it has like a dozen paragraphs in that chapter, a lot of them will have three paragraphs. So they'll have a paragraph on the sons of Japheth, and then they'll have a paragraph on the sons of Ham, and then they'll have a paragraph on the sons of Shem. And mm-hmm. in the Masoretic tradition, there are three sections, but they're not Japheth, Ham, and Shem. Instead, they're Japheth and Ham, except for Canaan. And then the second one is Canaan, who's one of the sons of Ham. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is Shem. And what that division does is it really highlights the contrast between Canaan and Shem, which fits into one of the themes for the end of Genesis 1 to 11 and sets up the mm-hmm. rest of the Torah.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting, especially we just went through the sin of Ham and the curse of Canaan in Genesis 9. And I followed Seitz and Bergsma's article from JBL. I don't know if you read that, John, but the listeners to this podcast, I think will find that really interesting, you know, what Sam just said and how, you know, how the descendants of Canaan, you know, the Canaanites, as it were, I guess you could say, are set off and contrasted like that. That's really interesting, actually, you know, how that is telegraphed. I like telegraphing. You know, we, when I come across the, you know, something like that, where it's pretty clear that, again, there's some intentionality behind this, and you're supposed to think something. I mean, you're supposed to notice that the writer did this, or if you're hearing it with a good reader, you're going to pick up on it by ear. What might that be? So I think that's important. Now you you brought up the Dead Sea Scrolls. Do you have any sort of textual commitment? You're going to stick to the Masoretic text. You're going to observe, you know, Qumran readings that, you know, might be, you know, superior and here and there. Do you have a predilection there as you keep going, you know, after Genesis? I assume you're going to do the whole Torah here at least. Do you have any sort of guiding philosophy yet on that?
Yeah, we do. And we do plan to finish Genesis, the rest of Genesis in short order and continue with other portions of the Hebrew Bible. It'll be interesting to see. We've got some ideas on that. Mm-hmm. We made a very explicit commitment to the Masoretic text and also to the Koray, that is to the text as it has been read. And we explained that in the introduction. We don't mean to imply by making that choice that the Masoretic text is always the best text, however you might define that. There's more than one way to define that, of course. But we thought it would be a very important thing to stick to one text. In this case, also, it works for this book very easily. Codex Leningradensis is, without a doubt, the best available witness to the Masoretic tradition. We paid attention to other witnesses as well, but that's what we've got. And it's interesting when you do that, when you make a strong commitment to one text, how then when you see when there is variation, what advantages there are to being consistent. So I guess it's a strength that we want to cultivate in the translation in more than one way, and that is consistency. And so we're consistent also in terms of textual basis.
Yeah, and you can always address things in notes, you know, extensive notes. You don't have to mar the consistency you're trying to shoot for otherwise. I mean, you can bring up whatever you need to bring up later on. And most, you know, most translations will opt for that. Even the one that we did in the building, which really didn't start out as an effort to produce a translation of, you know, great literary quality. And, you know, I'll be the first to say that it's not, you know, it hasn't had that much thought put into it. We did it for different reasons, but, you know, we made the same decision there, you know, editorially. It was just easier rather than having to evaluate so many different things, just stick with the text. And if there's something that's really important, you say something about it at that point, you know, in a note. How about the divine name? I noticed you opt for Lord. Again, is that to create continuity with other translations, or is there something else behind that?
Yeah, definitely it is to maintain continuity with a tradition that goes back all the way to the Septuagint. And it does have its, you know, there's always a cost in doing something like this. Whenever I talk to a JW, it's always a matter of discussion, right? So I realize that. For me, the struggle in particular is when I'm translating the Psalms and I'm used to reading the Hebrew as a prayer, it seems very confining not to use the tetragrammaton, the name of God in some way, because that's very much a part of the content and the form, is to address God with a name rather than title. So. There are drawbacks, there's no doubt. The fact that we have Lord obviously connects Genesis in a way that it connected with people in for Jesus himself and for Jesus' day, because that's the substitute that they were familiar with and that was not changed. It didn't. That's what I'll point out to a JW, is just say, well, I don't think Jesus thought that was an issue. no change on that matter. And so we preserve that, and at the same time, we make a note about it so people are aware of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Sam, I'd like, if you can, come up with an example of where your specialty, again, the legal language, where that, I don't know what the right word is here, where that influenced mm-hmm. how you translated something, or you know, if there's a better word, give us the better word, but how was that a factor? Can you give us an example?
So I'll give an example from the figure of speech Hendiadys. It's a figure of speech I'm interested in. And according to the Genesis commentators, it shows up a lot in Genesis. Great. So
define that for Hendiadys.
Hendiadys is a figure of speech where you have two terms separated by a conjunction, and they work like and they work together as a single unit of meaning. So if I'm a farmer and I say my cow is nice and fat, I don't mean two things. My cow has a good disposition and my cow's fat. I mean one thing. Nice and fat is nicely fat, quite fat. Only one thing, not two. And so one question is whether Hendiadys shows up in Genesis. Another question is whether Hendiadys shows up in the Constitution. And I've written legal scholarship on that. And some examples, I think, from the U.S. Constitution are necessary and proper and cruel and unusual. And probably, though I haven't written on this one at length, advice and consent. So those are examples of Hendiadys. One question is whether it shows up in Genesis. So some people think an example would be without form and void. And so if you think it's a Hendiadys, then you're more likely to paraphrase that structure, that A and B structure, and say something like the Revised English Bible does, a vast waste. But having thought about the figure of speech and the different ways languages can connect words and use them in parallel phrases, John and I came to the conclusion that this one and some other instances too in Genesis 1 to 11 aren't really examples of Hendiadys, but are more like rhyming pairs. So they're not trying to use two different terms to work together in a complex relationship, but rather it's sort of like might and main, or shaven and shorn, or bold and brazen, where in English we put two words together that are similar, and they're getting most of the added forces just from the sound, the sort of playful almost accumulation of intensity that comes from the sound. So it's a very fine point, like how are these words related and how do they play off each other? But that's a point where thinking through an issue thoroughly for legal scholarship helped with translating Genesis.
Are you taking instances each on their own merits or demerits? I mean, Genesis 1-2, you have void and desolate. Right. But I'm thinking, okay, what about something like be fruitful and multiply?
I think that's probably the best instance, the phrase that has the best claim to be a Hendiadys in Genesis 1-11. So be fruitful and multiply are not two separate things, but it's not a mere repetition. It's a multiply being fruitfully, or be fruitful in the sense of multiplying. So I think that's probably more like a Hendiadys than anything else in Genesis. Good call.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. Because again, I'm hoping that listeners, you know, sort of pick up on, hey, there's a lot to think about. You know, in other words, it's not just looking at one language. Okay, I know what that word is in Hebrew, so now I'm going to pick an equivalent English word, and there we go. Then I'll move to the next word. You know, it just because we get this sort of impression that, especially, and I like formal equivalents. You know, and I realize it can be caricatured, and I'm going to caricature it a little bit here. But you know, this enterprise of having to account for every word, like it's an atomistic process. And then when I'm on the other side of it, I've accounted for every word. And then, okay, well, we're not going to change any of those words, but we're going to try to make it more readable. And then that's a translation. You know, it is difficult to try to, again, communicate what's there without dispensing with something that might be important. And on the flip side, you know, without being sort of, you know, this, you're enslaved by this compulsion, you know, to account for every word. I mean, here's an example where you're talking about, you know, how to even think about, you know, two words juxtaposed to each other. You know, what do we do with that? There's just a lot to think about when it gets right down to it. What do either of you think about the comfort level of readers? Do you care about the comfort level of readers with respect to translation? I'm going to pick an example here to illustrate this that's outside Genesis 1 through 11, but I do that to get the point across. Hasatan in Job 1 and 2. You know, typically, you know, we're going to see Satan with a capital S in that passage. And that's in many respects, that's a concession to the expectation of the modern reader. So do you guys care about that? Do you care about conceding anything there? Or how would you approach something that, you know, well, if we fiddle with this, the reader's going to wonder, well, hey, all the Bibles I've ever read say it this way, and now you're doing something different with it. What are your thoughts there?
Well, we certainly struggle with it. I'll let Sam give the example, one that we struggle with a lot. And that's where, so everyone knows where the ark landed, right? but if you read our translation, it lands somewhere else.
I know where you're going with this. Go ahead, get into it.
Everybody thinks it's Ararat. And we went with Urartu.
Yeah. And tell them why. I actually just read something totally unrelated that where this actually came up, so it's kind of fresh in my mind, but go ahead.
Ararat is certainly the traditional name, so it's exactly what English Bible readers expect. But the problem is it's easy to misunderstand because it's easy to think that it refers to what in later tradition came to be called Mount Ararat, when instead the text, both here and throughout the Hebrew Bible, when the word comes up, is referring to an ancient land, the ancient land of Urartu, what we would now call Armenia. And so actually some translations, I think Douay Rheims has Armenia as where the ark lands, if memory serves. But there, because readers are likely to misunderstand the traditional rendering, we went with a rendering that is very exact according to the term used in contemporary Assyriological scholarship, but not the familiar one. It throws the reader off just a little bit, but throws the reader off maybe from misunderstanding rather than from understanding.
Yeah, I mean, the text has a plural there, mountains of course, the traditional rendering there is Ararat. So, you know, the Hebrew is obviously not indicating a specific mountain, but more of a region, something more regional. So yeah, I actually like that, you know, mountains of Urartu is how you render it here, because you can't really be specific. And, you know, it has me wondering, you know, if people are going to, you know, flag that and wonder what in the world you were thinking there. But I imagine you have notes on that are going to get into it.
Indeed. We have 135 pages of notes. And so it's not going to answer every translation question, but it's going to be a lot of fun for people because it can help you, no matter what translation you're reading, to understand some of the decisions that went on behind it. Mm-hmm. I think, Michael, more generally, the question of the comfort of the reader is a really important one, and it's a reminder of why there can't be any one perfect translation, because every translation is going to make different choices about the comfort of the reader. And there are a number of places in our translation where you might say that what we've aimed for is not the comfort of the reader as much as the comfort of the rereader. Mm-hmm. And what John and I are asking the reader for is the kind of suspension of judgment to not expect it to be a quick, disposable, skimmable kind of project. It's not a translation for skimming. It's a translation for reading closely, savoring, and rereading. And we think that reader is going to be really comfortable but you have to be prepared to be that reader.
Well, I'm going to say right now that I think, you know, it's the book is Genesis 1 through 11, but personally, I think the notes are worth the price of the book, because for someone who doesn't, you know, read Hebrew, who can't, you know, go back and get under the hood in that way, this is almost going to be like a translation commentary, and really, really take people who read this as a translation and then follow the rabbit trails in the notes. I think they're going to learn a tremendous amount just by doing that exercise. It's one of the reasons why the only thing I think I can compare this to, and you guys have gone beyond it considerably, is the Net Bible, you know, online, where they try to explain why they rendered something this or that, and you know, like, well, this is a pronoun here, but we substituted this noun because of the con. They'll get into things like that, the nuts and bolts sort of details of why they're doing what they're doing, maybe with a tense or a participle or something like that. But you guys are going considerably beyond that sort of thing. And if people get this and just look at the notes, it's going to really amp up what they get out of, you know, reading the text and having to think about what they're reading, why it is what it is. So I just wanted to throw that out, you know, at this point, because we have this issue with Urartu. People are just going to learn a lot, you know, by following a bunny trail like that. I have two more questions. What do you think about preserving ambiguity? I know this is asking for a lot in translation, but there are just passages, and I'm going to use a New Testament illustration for the listener to, again, sort of help us all understand what I'm getting at here. But like 1 Corinthians 7:1. If you look that up in different translations, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. It's good for a man not to have sexual relations. It's good for a man not to marry. I mean, you can justify any one of those in different ways, but if you're just looking at the text, it is the lemma for touch. And so a rendering that is something like that preserves ambiguity and refrains from interpretation. So how do you feel about the issue of preserving ambiguity in a translation?
I think it's important to preserve ambiguity. We're not trying to create ambiguity, but where the text can be read in different ways, and especially where through the history of interpretation by Jewish and Christian authors, it has been read in different ways, we want to try to keep those lines of interpretation open for the reader. One place where we do that is in Genesis 2, when God makes the garden. We have in Genesis 2:8, and the Lord God planted a garden in Eden aforetime in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And there's a crucial ambiguity about whether it means in the east or it means aforetime, in former times. And mm-hmm. So we've put both of those in the translation to try to point in, because the phrase can point in either direction, and we want to leave that open and not close it down for the reader where possible.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting example, again, because, again, for somebody who doesn't read Hebrew, the lemma there, kadem, can be either, just like you said, east or, you know, some other, you know, qualifier, you know, like beforehand or in the past or something like that. Yeah, that's really interesting. John, are you on board with that? I would think you are, since you're partners on this.
Right, yeah. No, we did work hard in several key instances to preserve a range of interpretive possibilities, sometimes because that's just how things go. A particular word, a particular phrase in Hebrew has a wide resonance, and it takes some work to pick a phrase that in English is as extensive in its possible resonance. Mm-hmm. We also do something I think is worth pointing out, and that is not always, because there's many, but in a number of key instances, we try to carry over some wordplay. And Mike, you know all about this. You read Hebrew, so you know how often there is wordplay going on. And maybe a good example is at the border between chapters 2 and 3, mm-hmm. where it talks about the two of them, as being naked, and then the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. And then the next line, in fact, there's no division in the Masoretic text. It's part of the same paragraph. Now, the serpent, what we translate, was smooth and shrewd beyond every other beast of the field, because there is a play here, a word play. There's a word for cunning, for shrewdness, and it sounds very similar to the word for nakedness in Hebrew. And a number of commentators very skillfully have pointed out how the wordplay here is intentional. And we draw attention to that in the notes, and we do what's called a double translation. Smooth captures the connection with nakedness, and shrewd represents the standard meaning, if you wish, of this term.
Yeah, that's a good example. Last question. What do you think, and John, you're a pastor, so this is going to be, I think, in your wheelhouse, but we have a lot of pastors that listen to the podcast, but what do you think the responsibility of the pastor is when it comes to what we've been talking about, translation? Should the pastor be introducing people to options and alternatives? Why or why not? Because I can imagine some would think, well, you know, good grief, on a Sunday morning, I don't want to, you know, be getting people, you know, confused, you know, quote unquote confused by all the possible things there are to think about in their Bible. I'd just be thrilled if they'd read the thing. And so that could create sort of an inner compulsion or propensity to just avoid getting into these sorts of issues, really getting into the text at this level or in this way. What would you recommend, or do you have any strong feelings one way or the other on what the pastoral job is here when it comes to what we're talking about?
Yeah, well, I certainly have a strong belief in the fundamental Reformation doctrine of the clarity of Scripture. And at the same time, there are passages which can easily be understood in more than one way. And so how to hold those things in tension and be honest about it. I think in the end, it pays to be honest about passages that are difficult. It wasn't just the Ethiopian eunuch who was able to admit, I don't understand this. That's a good point of departure. We can go from there rather than just assuming that we understand it. It's a certain humility is helpful. And that's interesting. The example of the Ethiopian eunuch is actually relates to Genesis 1 through 11, because we made a choice too with some of the place names. So the word in Hebrew for Ethiopia is Cush, and that often just gets transliterated. So Nimrod is from the land of Cush, and but we give it the same equivalent that was already. We already find this Septuagint, which is Ethiopia. And what's interesting about that is then that connects us all the way to the New Testament. And if you don't pick a term that bridges the two testaments, then you're not going to see the connection. Who would guess that the land of Cush and the land of Ethiopia are the same unless you give a concordant translation?
Michael, I think your last two questions are related too, because if a translation leaves ambiguity open and leaves open the room for interpretation, then it does make it easier on the pastor, because you don't have to preach against the decision made in the text.
Yeah, that's a good point. Do you guys, either one of you, have a passage you'd like to read? You know, something that is substantial, but not another half hour. That sort of thing. Just give us a flavor of something that might bring out some of these things we've been talking about to give listeners a sample. I've already said, I didn't put it this way, but I'll put it this way now. Even if you don't like the translation, the notes are just worth the price of the book. But the translation is, again, the centerpiece here. It's the sweet spot of what John and Sam are doing. But can you give us a sampling?
I can read Cain and Abel.
Okay, go ahead.
Genesis chapter 4. Now the man knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I gained a man through the Lord. And she bore again his brother, Abel. And Abel was a herder of sheep, and Cain was a worker of the ground. And it happened, at the end of a span of days, that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. And Abel, he also brought an offering, of the firstlings of his flocks, of their fat pieces. And the Lord looked with favor upon Abel and his offering, but upon Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. And Cain burned greatly with anger, and his face fell. And the Lord said to Cain, why does it make you burn with anger, and why has your face fallen? If you mean well, will your face not be lifted up? And if you do not mean well, at the door couches sin. Toward you is his longing, and it is you who must rule over him. And Cain said to Abel his brother, and it happened, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. And the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel your brother? And he said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now cursed are you by way of the ground, which gaped wide her mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. If you work the ground, no longer shall she give her strength to you. A trembler and a wanderer shall you be upon the earth. And Cain said to the Lord, my iniquity is too weighty to be forgiven. See, you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground, and from your face I must hide, and I shall be a trembler and a wanderer upon the earth, and so it will happen. Everyone who comes upon me will kill me. And the Lord said to him, therefore, everyone who kills Cain, sevenfold vengeance shall be taken upon him. And so the Lord granted Cain a sign, lest everyone who came upon him should slay him. Then Cain went out from the face of the Lord and dwelt in the land of wandering, east of Eden.
Yeah, there, in that selection, I mean, I was looking at ESV, again, which, again, I think leans toward formal equivalence. But what you were reading does bring out, like, repetition in that section in a few places where ESV doesn't. I thought it was interesting. The ESV has the Lord put a mark on Cain. I mean, you can still get the idea that this is something God's doing to help him or something, you know, some favorable act, you know, to some merciful act. But granted, I think brings that out better. There were just a number of things in there that, you know, would draw attention. And again, for those who, you know, for listeners, I do recommend getting this because you could use this and compare it with the translation you're used to and then take advantage of the notes. Why are they doing what they're doing? And on the one hand, you might be used to a study Bible doing a little of that. Here you're going to get a full-blown discussion of the things that really need to be thought about. Whether you know agree with where John and Sam come down on this is sort of immaterial, but what sort of thought process went into this and what sort of thought process needs to go, you know, into the whole enterprise? I think it's really valuable. So I want to thank you both for doing the work. Yeah, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Before we go, John, is there a blog or website, anything you'd like to promote or we could read more about you?
Well, you can always check out my blog, Ancient Hebrew Poetry, easy to find. But I think Glossahouse, our publisher, who I'm sure will work with you guys in the future, has a special discount. I think you have the information.
We do. I got it. The discount code word is Get Naked, so I love it.
Is it spelled N-E-K-K-E-D?
No, it's N-A-K-E-D. Yeah, it's normal. It's Get Naked. I don't know how I'll say it.
All right, so what's the website where you would put in the discount code?
Well, I'll put the link on our website for everybody. Okay. So if you go to nakedbiblepodcast.com, I'll have a link there with the discount code, Get Naked, so you can get it. Yeah. But Sam, spell is there any G-E-T-N-A-K-E-D. There you go. That's a discount code. Sam, is there anything, anywhere we can find more about you, blog, anything you'd like to promote?
No, I'm not a regular blogger, though I will be doing on a legal blog at the Washington Post. I'm going to do a 10-part series on the translation coming up next month.
Awesome.
Wow, that's interesting. Now you can throw in your work about the Constitution as well. I'm sort of a political junkie in the sense that I listen to a lot of talk radio, and I was a political science minor. So that's something I'm actually interested in. But again, what's the title of that? And I imagine it's on Amazon, right?
Well, the long article on Hindiatus, if that's the one you mean,
the book. Oh, you have a book on this.
Yes, I'm on an author of a case book, The Constitution of the United States. That's with several other law professors, and you can get it on Amazon, and you can get a link to it from my webpage at UCLA.
Is that used as a textbook anywhere, or?
Yes, you know? It's okay. A textbook used in a number of law schools.
Okay, all right. And the reading level, I mean, is it a, you know, what kind of level of detail are we at, or is this just an overview of the issues?
So it's a book that's intended for law students, but part of what my co-authors and I think is really important is that the Constitution is not the preserve and special possession just of lawyers and judges. Mm-hmm. It's the mm-hmm. people's Constitution. We the people have adopted it, and we think it should be of interest to everyone. So I think the book is going to be interesting to everyone, but I should warn you, it's got the price of a textbook. So it is not cheap, but that's the idea. It's for everybody's constitution, and we want to explain everybody's constitution to law students.
Good. All right. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I hope your listeners will check out Glossa House, our publisher. They can go directly to Glossa House. That's not too easy. Not too hard. Glossa, GLSSA, Glossa House. And you'll find it easy to order the book, pre-order it. It'll be out very soon.
Okay. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, all the best, Mike. Great to, great to
work together. Thanks.
Okay, bye for now. Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right, Mike. Well, that was another good one. It's always interesting getting into the textual criticism or translations, if you will, of the Bible.
Yeah, I think people, you know, listeners will appreciate, again, that there's a lot to think about here. You know, what John and Sam are trying to do is really really a literary work, to try to treat the Bible as a literary work of artistry and try to preserve, again, the writer's intentionality in ways that, you know, are really hard for us to detect because of translation. A lot of translations obscure things that we're supposed to notice, you know, that our attention's supposed to be drawn to. So I think what they're doing here is really worthwhile.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to reading that. And then the book, again, is Genesis 1 through 11, a new old translation. And they have a discount code for all of our listeners, and that's GetNaked, GetNaked. That's the discount code. I will put the link to what's funny about that, Mike.
Did you talk them into that?
No, I didn't. I love it.
Of course.
It's perfect. I love it. So I'll put the actual link to their publisher on the nakedbiblepodcast.com website. Go over there, get naked, get you a discount. I didn't do this. He did it. So
yeah,
so it's perfect.
I know.
That's perfect.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
Absolutely. So, you know, please go over there, get the book. Can't wait to read it. But Mike, next week, be careful because I'm looking at you. I'm giving you the evil eye.
I know. Yeah, we're going to do an episode on the evil eye, believe it or not. There's a passage in Ecclesiastes that sort of factors into this idea, again, of the way somebody looks at you sort of affects you in various different ways. This is actually part of ancient Near Eastern lore or belief. And so I've actually been asked this a couple times, you know, in email and such, and it would surprise you to know that there's actually a decent amount of scholarly material on this. So we're going to take a crack at, you know, talking about the evil eye here on the podcast.
I don't know if I should be excited or worried, because I'm going to be constantly head on a swivel. But all right, Mike. Well, again, we just want to thank John and Sam for coming on and talking with us. And also, Mike, we decided that we're going to open up our voting for the next book that we're going to cover on July 1st. So the voting will open up on July 1st and run through July 23rd at midnight. So you'll have to wait and stay tuned to what you're actually going to be voting on. But we got three choices for you. So July 1st, the voting will begin. And again, just want to thank John and Sam for coming on. And just want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.